Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast.
Hello again, listeners. It's another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast. This might be a slightly tricky weekly podcast to make a cheerful weekly podcast, given that the last week is anything but cheerful in Arsenal land, but we'll do our best. I'm joined by Paul Williams, who has taken the very sensible decision of taking time off work to watch the snooker, but instead is deciding to talk to me for a bit, which makes me feel very honoured because I'm tearing him away from his screen and his beloved. How are you, Paul?
I'm very well, mate. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm a little bit sort of frazzled generally, partly just because trying to work out what can be said about Arsenal that isn't just going to be a gloom fest is possibly a little bit of a challenge, but we'll do our best. I mean, there's nowhere else really to start apart from, well, the shit tip of results we've had in recent weeks in our two away games. I mean, as if losing at home to Crystal Palace, who are a very good away team, wasn't bad enough. At least that could be put down to individual errors of a Mustafi-esque calamity nature. But against both Wolves and Leicester, I mean, we just weren't any good.
Yeah, I probably should have mentioned before we started recording, I didn't actually see the Wolves game because I was watching the aforementioned snooker. But my uncle was keeping me updated on WhatsApp and was desperate for someone to share in his rage. I gathered we conceded from the first three shots on target and didn't really show up, and it's the same story as we appear to have been watching for pretty much the last 3 years away from home.
I mean, I have to say, I actually thought we were better against Wolves against Leicester. It's just that when we were in the ascendancy in the first 20 minutes, we didn't take our chances and ended that very, as you say, last few years thing of kind of relaxing into a game when, you know, oh, this isn't too difficult, the opposition on. And then, of course, as anyone who's watched Wolves know, they have a habit of starting slowly, looking a bit ropey, and then all of a sudden they flick a switch and come flying out the blocks. But I suppose that game, at least Wolves got the first goal through an absolutely fantastic free kick, and therefore it felt a little bit like we were going to be up against it after that moment, and that was really a match-defining moment, even though we created pretty much fuck all. But against Leicester, we were just outplayed from first to last. I mean, it was not good.
Yeah, it's the man who can work out why Arsenal can't start games away from home with any sort of intensity will end up being a very rich man indeed. I came away from that game just feeling as though we get overpowered by 90% of the teams we go and play away against, even the Watford game where we won. I was sort of making light of it afterwards because my uncle was really angry about that game. I was like, yeah, no, it was brilliant, back to the Wolves. You know, and I was sort of taking the mickey a little bit, but he probably saw through that. I would think he's only known me my whole life. But, you know, even that Watford game where we had the man advantage, they were better than us. And then this game on Sunday, we just play at one pace all the time, it feels like. And I think you can put Aubameyang and Lacazette up top and, you know, they're worth having on the pitch. But if you can't get the ball to them, then it's pointless.
Pretty much, yes. I mean, one of the things we're seeing is obviously that some of these mid-table teams have enough good players that if you don't take control of the game, they can do you some serious damage. You know, I mean, both Wolves and Leicester have players, and even a couple of players in the Palace squad, you know, there are players in those teams that we would quite happily stick in, either in our first 11 or on the bench in quite significant numbers.
Oh, we'd take Wolford Zaha in a heartbeat, wouldn't
yeah.
we?
Yeah, and even though he's a bit one-paced physically, you'd take Ruben Neves out of Wolves, for sure. I mean, on current form, you'd definitely take Diego Jota, who is scaring the shit out of every defence he plays against at the moment with his just combination of pace, but also Bernardo Silva-like work rate, which is very much in evidence against us.
Yeah, I saw a tweet on Twitter, obviously. I saw a tweet on Facebook. I could have done, I guess. A couple of days ago, basically said, every team in the Premier League, I don't know if it was every team in the Premier League, but most of the teams in the Premier League have got at least one player that would improve this Arsenal side.
Yeah, I mean, you might struggle to find that from Cardiff.
Yeah.
Or yeah. Huddersfield. But yeah, I mean, it is a valid point. And it's a reflection of where things are at the moment. And what's so interesting, of course, is that you look at this Arsenal team at home, and bar the Palace game where, I mean, that was basically an exercise in how to concede shit goals against a team that essentially you're in control against. But you compare the away performances to the home performances, and even though we're not always convincing at home, the team seems to carry with it enough personality and confidence to be able to kind of deal with some adversity and kind of try and take control of games. But away from home, that's just totally lacking. I mean, obviously part of it is, you know, atmosphere and officiating, because we all know the match officials are always influenced by which ground they're at. You know, most referees statistically are hometown referees to a certain degree, and if you're in a physical battle again, then, you know, I suppose a greater leniency towards that physicality from an opposition is going to impact a little bit, but I think that's it's such a minor influence, really, in the grand scheme of it.
It's you don't want to go on about the referees, because like, the referees aren't why Arsenal don't play away from home.
No.
But, you know, when you see Michael Oliver ignoring that foul on Torreira, and then Ainsley Maitland-Niles, I mean, the first booking I thought was soft. But when you saw the replay and you see him put his arm across, you can sort of understand that. I mean, Troy Deeney got sent off for something in the same sort of ballpark a couple of weeks ago. And everyone agreed that he deserved to be sent off. But the second foul, if he makes any contact with Maddison, it's like the very, very end of the guy's toe. And I would question whether he even made contact with that much of Maddison.
Well,
sort of just to whip out a yellow card for that straight away. You know, it seems to me that as Arsenal fans, we watch teams have players that dive in on our players and pile in, and they get spoken to and then they get booked and then they get spoken to again. And Arsenal don't seem to get the same
latitude.
Latitude.
Yeah. I can only agree. I mean, I think that the consistency in refereeing is so lacking in this country. And I know it's an incredibly difficult job, but there seems to be no... I mean, it's partly difficult because the Premier League match officials body has no transparency to it, so we have no idea what they do. And they make sure that nothing ever gets out of there. But what we see suggests there is no great drive to achieve consistency. I mean, you're never going to have complete consistency because their laws are not rules, and therefore they're fundamentally open to interpretation, blah, 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 blah. But the fact is whether it's the same referee or whether it's different referees, you know that an identical scenario is going to result in a different outcome depending on who the individuals involved are, or what the weather's like, or how the person felt when they got out of bed that morning, or whatever. And it is just maddening, because there is no way of predicting what an outcome is going to be, and it does lead to obviously controversy, and it does lead to accusations of bias. And you know, there is no doubt that some teams get the rub of the green more than the others. And despite the fact that the same old Arsenal always cheating song is always very popular anywhere outside of London amongst all those fucking idiots that just like the scan of the song and therefore don't interrogate how accurate it is compared to any of their rivals. And of course they do it because it winds us up. But. The fact is,
if referees watched their games back, and you sort of like to think they would, I don't understand how Michael Oliver could look back on that game and think, "Oh yeah, I definitely made the right decision there."
Well, the thing is, it's one of those situations you could see how both of those bookings could sort of be bookings in isolation. But the fact is they're so rarely bookings in other circumstances, and even with that same game, the equivalences weren't bookings. So
James Maddison did one later on, didn't he?
Well, also just looking at other Arsenal players, it seems like Maitland-Niles was treated more harshly than other players even on his same team, let alone compared to the opposition. You know, not that there were any particularly bad fouls, but neither of his fouls were particularly bad. And it did definitely show, and also the way that the referee started to play advantage until the second he realised it was a second yellow opportunity did make me sort of, it did have a slight hint of the Mike Deans about it, in that, oh, I can actually stop it and make it all about this moment now, which was a little galling, because I think most people agree that Michael Oliver is on balance one of the better referees we've got, but I have seen signs this season of him starting to get the slight Mike Dean ego at times, which I think it would be a terrible shame if that does become part of
it. I was trying to remember, I should have looked this up. We played at Spurs a couple of seasons back, maybe 3 years ago. We drew 2-2. We had a player sent off because they dived on the touchline.
Yeah.
Or they dived it. Maybe it was a foul. I've remembered it wrong. Someone got sent off for diving in on Harry Kane.
Yeah, yeah.
And they got sent off. So we were down to Alexis Sanchez scored with about 10 minutes left and we got a draw out of it. But Eric Beer committed four different fouls in that 15 minutes. He could have been sent off for any of them and he stayed on the pitch. And the referee was Michael Oliver.
Yeah.
I remember he sent Angel Di Maria off against in the FA Cup a few years ago. And that's like the last favour he did us. Not that you want favours from referees, you just want them to be consistent. And I think that's Michael Oliver in the same game is just giving different decisions according to who the player is that's committed the fouls.
I mean, I find it is frustrating because it does seem in the last couple of years he's gone from being one of those referees that's quite nice to us to being one of those referees that isn't nice to us at all anymore.
Yeah.
and maybe that's what happens when you have to do to climb up the ladder in the Premier League match officials group. But certainly I see him watching, I watch quite a lot of football and I see him refereeing other games, and he is still better than most, than a lot of the other referees. I mean, he's not like Martin Atkinson's got a bit better this year actually, but like Anthony Taylor, who's just an awful referee, and who's that slightly fat one who's the Scouser who refereed with us the other week and gave us sweet fuck all as well.
Not Kevin Friend, was it?
No. Kevin Friend is wonderfully forgettable as a referee. John Moss.
Oh God!
Him and Anthony Taylor. But every time I see them refereeing any game with any team, I think they're bad. Whereas Michael Oliver, at least I see in other games where I don't have any kind of particular emotional investment, to think, okay, well, generally you're quite a good referee, but yeah, it's true that in the last year or so he's given us a lot less than perhaps we're due for. But then you look at the penalties that we haven't, I mean, Lacazette should have won between 5 and 10 penalties this season that he's just not been given, which have been blatant penalties. And yet, a Spurs player or Mo Salah needs to be farted near in the penalty area, and it's pointing to the spot at alarming speed.
About 3 years ago, I thought to myself, "Guys, it's going to be great when the referees crack onto Spurs and what they're up to." And just year after year, they get away with it.
I would go as far to say that Spurs would not be a Champions League club if they were refereed in the same way as certain other teams.
Yeah.
But, to their credit, their team is at present better than ours and has been for the last 3 years. So, they don't deserve it any less than us, even if they have been a bit fucking cheaty. And Pochettino has admitted to coaching them to cheat as well, which is the most galling thing about it. When you come out and say that, we kind of get the players to do this, and you kind of think, hello? Did no one...
Yeah.
But anyway, it's partly because... I would say there's quite a heavy Spurs influence in the media, actually. I presume you've heard about the stories that have been going around the last couple of days about all the dissent at Arsenal and players mystified by team selection and not understanding the tactics.
Yeah.
And you look at the source of that story, Spurs fan journalist. And then the first next two people to repeat it, also Spurs fans, journalists. Let's get some momentum going here, guys.
Okay.
Which is
I'll admit to a bit, I've been on a bit of a media lockdown. Well, it's not even a media lockdown. I've just been watching Snoop.
Which at this time is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, obviously, the worst thing about all this is we're in a situation where. If we had just managed to not totally bollocks either any of our last three league games, we'd be favourites for a top four spot. Because the other teams we're competing with have also bollocks things up at their end.
it's an interesting thing. I was thinking to myself this on the way back from the gym, I was like, maybe we're not ready to go back in the Champions League yet. You know, if it doesn't happen this year, I mean, it'll be annoying to have another year in the Europa League. And I know that it obviously has potential with for us. But I'm not sure. Actually, I'm going to write back from that a little bit because I think Unai Emery has been very unlucky with losing the players that he's lost. Hmm. I do think that.
Holding Bellingham well.
What we're seeing now is a squad that's been stretched a little bit. You know, my mate Chris was straight on WhatsApp after the game on Sunday and he said, imagine the furore if Wenger was overseeing these last few games. And it's like, Chris, we lived this for the last 3-4 years, mate.
Yeah.
But we've been without Bellerin since January, Rob Holding since December, Danny Welbeck since then, and these are all players that were contributing to the squad and the team, and they were helping us get results. I think Danny Welbeck's been a huge miss for us. I think that
as a result of Welbeck's injury, the player who's played most appearances this season is Alex Iwobi, who is a decent player and a decent squad filler, but should not be a first choice player at Arsenal at this point in his career, and possibly not ever.
The thing with Iwobi that we've talked about this quite a lot over the last couple of years, is there isn't really anyone else in the squad that can do what he does from that position. Mkhitaryan can't really do that. Ozil won't do what Iwobi does. I really felt on Sunday a lot of the issues that we had, going back to a team that plays at one pace and we don't seem to have any power. We're overpowered by everyone. That Chowdhury in the Leicester midfield was field day with us. We don't have any pace wide. It won't be it.
Yeah. And he's not really a prototypical winger because he's not actually that quick. He's not slow, but he's not quick. And he's not really a winger, but he's the closest thing we've got to a winger in the squad. And it's one of the big problems we've had with our squad building. I mean, this is it. When people kind of go, oh, Unai Emery's not improved anything, I'm going, yeah, but look at the clusterfuck of the last 3 years of Wenger's period in time. And we had that wonderful FA Cup win against Chelsea, which was a day that I'll cherish for a long time. And we got, you know, we got a bit of Alexis still being brilliant, and we got Ozil when the team was still kind of built around him looking great. But the transfer business was just a fucking disaster. I mean, we sold every fucking wide player we had in the squad. We sold all of our homegrown players. So that's going to be a massive issue going forward, because we went from being the best stocked team for having homegrown players in the top kind of third of the table to now being, as you know, one of the worst stocked in that department. We've got no wingers.
How long has Sylvain wanted a left winger for?
Exactly.
I remember talking about that after that cup final.
Yeah, and also we've made fuck all money from like shipping off half a first team squad, and then you look at Spurs getting 20 million for Kevin Vimmer and things like that, and it's like, you know, it's an absolute joke. I mean, whoever has been in charge of that at this club if it was anyone other than Wenger, that person should be removed from the club too. And, you know, maybe that has happened because I hear that Dick Law's not around so much anymore. But the fact is, that's been an absolute disaster, and that set us back massively because we haven't had the money to reinvest because we've been giving players away. And also, we've been hanging on to players for too long. So we've ended up running down their contracts, or people like Jack, who, you know, we should have made a decision about his injury situation sooner than we did. And in the end, we ended up letting him go for nothing, and now he looks like a busted flash. He can't even get fit enough to play for West Ham. And we're reduced to the point of having to take on someone on loan that's even less effective for us than King fucking Shallstrom. I mean, at least King Shallstrom scored an important penalty and provided a bit of calm in a couple of games as a sub. Like, makes Yossi Benayoun look like...
very well, I know. It
makes Yossi Benayoun look like the signing of fucking Nicolas Anelka, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas without wishing to open the Denis Suarez, what's the fucking point can of worms? I mean, hey, players can get injured and it's unfortunate, but... it always looks like a bit of a long shot punt of a signing, and it's turned out to be even more long shotty and punty than we ever could have predicted. But then, you know, one of the things, as you say, is the lack of power and pace in midfield is still a massive issue. And I mean, we've known it's an issue for a while. Torreira at least adds a little bit of combativeness and kind of mobility over the first few yards, but he's not going to power through a midfield. And it's one of the difficulties, and it's one of the reasons I think we see this team, you know, we go and get two great results against Napoli, but then we get absolutely humiliated against Wolves, Palace and Leicester. And it's partly because the Europa League and even the Champions League, except for the best teams, is just played at a different pace and intensity to the Premier League. And it's and we've got a squad which is a good Europa League squad that might be able to kind of maybe win a couple of knockout games in the Champions League if we get a favourable draw. But we do not have a squad, and haven't for a number of years, got a squad that's built to really compete in the Premier League. You know, yes, we had a couple of title challenges that went off the rails, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. But even then, all it took is some real physical opposition and we'd always look a bit uncomfortable. This is the thing. I've seen a lot of sort of anti-Emery revisionism at the moment, but we've already said it. You know, every team, almost every team in the league has got someone that would improve our first team. And with silent Stan not looking to put his hand in his pockets, it's interesting to see, you know, that's the only reason we want Champions League football. It's not because any Arsenal fan thinks we can do anything in the Champions League. We know we fucking can't. We're just hoping that we might be able to get a bit more money in so we can get rid of some of the players in our squad that are basically a negative sum game and replace them, you know, replace them with something a bit more with more potential to eventually become a top draw player whilst also allowing us to bring in some of the youngsters. You know, the problem is not only do we have a slight lack of numbers in certain positions, but also we've got too many players that aren't good enough and aren't going to get any better. They've shown that in over a period of time. You know, I mean, we've seen under Emery this year, some players have improved, haven't they?
Yeah.
I mean, sadly, three of them got injured.
They were injured.
But also, we've seen Lacazette, despite not scoring more goals this season, his general play has really stepped up, and he deserves a lot of credit. And until his recent struggles with injury and then coming back from injury, what looks like too soon, Jacques has been better this season. Vastly better, but he's been better. So that, again, gives you some positivity there. Klasnac still can't fucking defend for shit, but at least he looks more competent going forward. Not that I think anyone believes he's a long-term solution, but there are sort of shoots of improvement there. But the problem is they've been undermined by too many players that just haven't got any better when the competition around us is better than it has been.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to admit, I didn't see all of the second half of the Leicester game, for which I was eternally grateful. I found myself having to get a train somewhere, so I was kind of catching snippets and radio and Twitter videos or whatever. But hey, 1-0 down to 10 men. this isn't Invincibles anymore.
They tried, and actually, the start of the second half, they they looked okay. They looked quite solid, and then we conceded that goal, and it was a hell of a delivery from our friend Madison. But obviously, once that goal goes in, it's a long road back, and you know we've seen Arsenal teams in the past be able to recover that sort of situation, but yeah, everyone knew, didn't they? But to concede that second goal, that's a horror show.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no two ways about it. I mean,
I'm not going to sit here and bag Lauren Koscielny because he's been pretty much brilliant for us for 10 years. So, you know, he's dragged his body. It's mad, isn't it? You think Koscielny dragged his body through any more hellfire than he did last season when he actually tore his Achilles tendon and he's been playing 3 games a week.
This is the thing. Yeah. There's been a lot of people complaining about why is Mustafi in the team? Why does Emery like Mustafi so much? You have the Matt Law and other Spurs reporters talking about all the players can't understand why Mustafi's in the team. You know, it's everyone hates Mustafi, including all the other players. Kind of, and it's like, yeah, we all fucking know it's because all the other defenders are fucking injured, you numpties. He's playing because there aren't enough warm bodies. He's playing because they're desperately trying to not play Koscielny in every single fucking game, and yet he's still having to come on in every fucking game. And yeah, Holding's injured, Sokratis was suspended, Monreal's had injury problems. Like, there's no one else to play unless you pull out some poor fucking Ballard out of the youth team who'd be totally out of his depth at that level. You know.
Yeah, there was an article on Football 365 about a month ago. I can't remember after which game it was maybe Everton. It's like the great irony of Scott Drummond's stuff. Finally, his continued error prone nature, but actually, he is our most durable centre back.
Yeah, so, exactly. I mean, part of the reason everyone hates him so much is because he never gets injured while everyone else does.
Yeah. And it's interesting, though, because that Spurs game a couple of months ago, he played so well at right back, and then he has this aberration where he shoves Harry Kane over in the penalty area. 75 minutes of playing really well, undone by 5 seconds of madness.
But that is Mustafi. Yeah, you know, he's got a lot about him, which is very good. And I'm sure that's what was on all the highlight videos that were sent to Arsene Wenger. But the problem is that in almost every game, he does something that makes you think, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. Well, that's normally in the... Actually, this Sunday was the first time in a long time that I've seen him go in for his first tackle of the game on his feet.
Yes, quite.
Which was, whoa.
I mean, I've heard a lot of people suggest recently that part of the big problem of his game is he's always trying to pass on responsibility.
Saw that Tim Steelman tweet.
I wasn't actually thinking of Tim Steelman. I'd sort of encountered the argument elsewhere, and I'm sure it has occurred to a few people. I suppose it doesn't really matter what the problem is. The fact is he is worse for us now than he was when he joined, and he hasn't shown any signs of improving in any of the areas of his game. So it becomes lit. And Emery's been, Emery's been trying to drop him. Like every time there's been enough defenders fit to drop him, he's dropped him.
Yeah.
You know, Mustafi has had a few games on the bench, but that's just because other people have been available. So it's pretty clear that despite what Matt Law and other twats who make a living out of writing bollocks, because they have to, because you've got to have your column inches every day, says, you know, the fact is Emery doesn't rate Mustafi, and clearly doesn't rate Mustafi. He just rates Mustafi more than playing Elneny at centre half or Lichtsteiner at centre half or some poor sod out of the youth team who would be dropped into it right at the pressure end of the season whenever every moment matters. And you know, Mustafi is a highly paid, experienced international player who, lest we forget, or ridiculous though it may sound, does have a World Cup winners' medal. I mean, I know that so does Adil Rami and Stefan Givash, so it's not exactly a great measure, as Sylvain reminded us last week. But the fact is, what else can the manager do? You know, he's got not enough players, and he's got too many players who aren't good enough. And it's not like, and you say, yes, a manager must improve players, and everyone kind of cites Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp improving players, but guess what happens to the players? They work out they can't improve, they're out the door in 5 fucking minutes.
And
the fact is that Man City can afford to buy a player for 40 million and go, oh well, didn't work out, fuck off, whereas Arsenal can't afford to do that. You know, I mean, there's no doubt that Pep Guardiola is a fantastic coach at improving players, but he doesn't waste his time working with players who aren't either very coachable or very, very good. And there is no doubt that Pep Guardiola is one of the best managers in the world if you've got a great team. But if you've got a mediocre team, I doubt very much he'd be that much more successful than anyone else.
Well, we don't know, do we? We've never seen it.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's only ever had the best squad in the country in any country he's managed in. So,
But it's, you know, I was lucky enough that I didn't get the... I was at my nan's for the Crystal Palace game, so I didn't see it. But I did see Mustafi's. I mean, that's almost like... I quit notice delivered to 60,000 people, isn't it? That sort of defending.
Well, again, it's him wanting someone else to take responsibility because he's not able to decide what to do quick enough.
But that's what I mean. When you do something like that in front of 60,000 people and everyone saw what happened, and I don't think anyone would attach any blame to the goalkeeper for that goal being scored.
Mm.
How is behaving like that going to be acceptable? And I think he'll get away with it till the end of the season because we haven't really got anyone else. But surely, I mean, Arsenal would take £5 million for him, wouldn't they?
Well, maybe.
I mean,
get him off the wage bill, I suppose. But
centre back on 90 grand a week and he does that. I mean, get it, you know, kick the ball out of the stadium if you have to. That's all he had to do. No,
I mean, it is that thing of every defender occasionally will make a fucking massive brain fart, but it's just that he does it with such regularity, it gives you no hope that it's going to improve. And we've seen no improvement in that area since he's arrived at the club. In fact, his best stint at the team is when he first arrived, when him and Koscielny actually looked like a really good partnership for a bit.
It is, yeah.
And then you realised after a while it's because Koscielny was still uber fit and able to cover for all of Mustafi's fuck up moments.
I think this is like when you look at him and then you compare him to someone like Socrates, who is, you know, he's not the most amazing defender in the world, but he wants to defend. He would have like booted that ball without even thinking about it, wouldn't he?
Well, that's the thing, is Socrates is in a lot of ways a more limited footballer than Mustafi, but he knows what his job is. And yeah, he's prone to terrible rash errors and occasions, but they're the kind of errors that fans find it a lot easier to forgive because they're errors born out of generally trying to either fix or resolve a situation rather than freezing or being passive. And Mustafi makes a lot of errors which are due to passivity or just not being where he should be and panicking. I mean, there is no doubt that you look at the fact that in recent weeks we've had, you know, even in the last few months, we've had some really bad defensive displays. But the games where the Mustafi has been not on the pitch, the defence has looked calmer and more in control. Against Napoli away, all right, that wasn't a great performance from Napoli. But we looked in control, and it's because there was no Mustafi in the team, and the rest of the defence just looked more relaxed because they seemed to all know their jobs better, whereas Mustafi either randomly abdicates responsibility or he tries to fight fires that aren't his to fight. And therefore, it unsettles the rest of the defence. And it's the thing is, it's clear that some of the other players have lost some confidence in him, and it's clear that the fans have lost confidence in him, which is obviously going to affect his performances negatively. But there is no way out of the situation other than getting him out of the club, or him literally being stuck all fucking summer training pitch a la George Graham, tied to for the defenders, being literally taught how to play his fucking position.
Yeah.
Which I think is probably not going to happen. I mean, as you alluded to elsewhere, against Palace on the counter-attack, albeit, and Wolves on the counter-attack, but more, even more worryingly against Leicester, our midfield looked really one-paced. And, I mean, we don't really have any options there either, do we, in the squad? Because the only person we could bring in who's fit is Elneny. Exactly.
Oh, Paul's dear. Just put the face, everyone.
What's happened to him? I went to the Burnley game before Christmas, and he played really well. He got dropped in from nowhere. Started the game, played really well. We took him off on about 65 minutes and proceeded to collapse. But his more recent outings into the team have been the Everton game, as you called it on the Slack group. It was a performance of cowardice, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that, I mean, he's never really been at the level that we needed, but he was the kind of player that you thought, in a simple shuffling box-to-box or holding role, could do a job. But now his confidence is totally shot, so he doesn't want the fucking ball. And he's repeated, and we've seen it quite a few games in a row now, where he's just taking up positions where you cannot get the ball to him, which means our midfield... You know, when he's been paired with Guendouzi, and Guendouzi's been trying to run the entire bloody midfield on his own because Elneny's hiding in plain sight, and not enough of other players have got the intelligence to help out. So you end up with Ozil dropping deep to play like the bloody Xhaka role because Elneny's just hiding.
Yeah.
And so he's another one who clearly has no... I mean, it's clear that Emery doesn't... Clear from the get-go that Emery didn't really rate him. But now his confidence is gone. So he needs to play somewhere else now. There's literally, unless something miraculous happens in the summer, there's literally no point in being here next year because he's just offering nothing because he's just gone as a player in terms of believing that he can succeed at this club, which is a real shame because he seems like a nice bloke. But at the end of the day, and he seems to at least be conscientious in an attempt. So, you know, he's not as frustrating as Mustafi because he's a much more limited footballer who...
Yeah, he tries.
But... Of late, that's even stopped because his confidence is gone.
I wonder if West Ham will take him.
Well, they've got a half-decent manager now, so they might not. So that's a centre-half we need. We're going to need someone in midfield with some legs, particularly as Ramsey's going, but even on top of that. And we need a winger.
I was sort of...
And maybe a left back.
Interested. I didn't read the full quotes. I don't know exactly what Unai Emery said, but I saw a hint that he might look to replace Aaron Ramsey internally.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
and I was just wondering who the likely candidate might be. If
that does happen, you're looking at Emil Smith Rowe or Joe Willock. I mean, obviously, we've seen a little bit of Smith Rowe this season. Before he got injured and then sent on loan to Leipzig, where sadly he's not played very much because he was injured for most of the time he's been on loan there. He's come off the bench a couple of times for, you know, 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there, but hasn't really had much impact because he's been injured. But he looked very promising in that kind of slightly more athletic number 10 role. And he can play in a sort of advanced number 8 role that Ramsey's pretty good at, although obviously he lacks the experience to really be comfortable in that role. And also Joe Willock's taken a big step forward for the under-23s this season and has added a real goal threat to his game that hasn't been there previously. I mean, yes, it's against crap opposition, but I think he's like our third or fourth highest scoring midfielder this season. He's got 3 goals in 4 games. And you know, apart from Ozil, Mkhitaryan, and Ramsey, no one else is scoring any. And that is something that we've missed. You know, he's also just, you know, he's not physically developed, and he may never be a good Arsenal player. We don't know, but he has at least got a mobility and a fluidity to his play that others are lacking. He's got a chance, but of course Emery's got to say that because there ain't no money, kids. So he's going to have to make some very big choices about where he spends that money this season, in the off season, because there are so many holes to patch up. Hard to know what to do, really. Obviously there are some bright spots in the youth team. We've seen a little bit this season of young Bukayo Saka, who's a young left winger who played a bit in the Europa League and in the cup competitions, who is, he's been pretty dominant at, he's still 17, but was too good for the under-18s. He played two games for them and like scored twice and assisted three times. And they're like, right, okay.
Right.
And then he went, and in the under-23s, he's almost got either a goal or assist per game at that level. And he's looked lively in the couple of games he's played at first team level. So he's got a chance to have an impact next season. And obviously he's a winger. Obviously Reece Nelson, who is less of a prototypical winger but can play at wide. He's going to be coming back from Hoffenheim. Emil Smith Rowe, as we mentioned, Joe Willock. They're the ones that are closest, and there are, you know, there are other players that may be worth a sniff. I think possibly the boat has sailed for Ben Sheaf because he's got injured at the wrong times, unfortunately. But you know, there's a couple of fullbacks, but right backs, or that might get a look in as the being backup for Hector Bellerin, I guess, because Nick Steiner and Jenko won't be here next year. that's the thing, is the chances are we're going to have a lot of wage budget to play with, but not a massive amount of transfer fees. So it'd be interesting to see if there's any sort of Bosman action happening. But of course, there aren't. You know, I suppose the most attractive Bosman signings out there are people like Adrian Rabiot, but he'll be going to someone. He'll be going to a Real Madrid or a Barcelona, won't he?
Yeah. When I saw the bench on Sunday, and I said to Chad, "Oh my God, there isn't a lot on there if it all goes wrong." And I guess Saka probably a bit too young to be thrown in, but bearing in mind he has got some ability and he is a winger, I sort of feel like he might have been worth at least putting on the bench.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see. Don't know if he came on against Leicester because I missed the second half of the second half. But
he put Nketiah on towards the end.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, because he had his little cameo against Wolves, I think, and basically offered more than a number of the other players, you know, offered more than Mkhitaryan had in the whole bloody game.
Yeah, there's a surprise.
I don't really know what to say beyond that. Mkhitaryan's such a frustrating player because some games he looks really good and other games he looks like bad. And so
he's almost, to me, like there's no sort of in between with him. He's either on it or he's not. And if he's not on it, it's a horror show.
Yeah.
It reminds me a bit of Theo Walcott. And I've probably said this before, but I can't believe that someone that played for Borussia Dortmund, Manchester United and now us is as bad on the ball as he is. Generally.
Well, it's that thing that he is, and then sometimes he's great.
And
he's one of those players that you know that, you know, he's been a key part of some of our best performances this season, but he's also been a key part of some of our worst performances. And it must be incredibly frustrating to manage. And you can see why Mourinho gave up on him quite quickly, because Mourinho does not accept that kind of level of variation. But then I suppose, you know, it's not like Alexis Sanchez has been tearing up trees for him three times a salary at Man United.
Well, I mean, I think that was always, I said even when we sold him, they'd be looking to sell him within 2 years. It seems to be happening a bit quicker than that. But the guy didn't have a break for how many years?
Yeah, yeah.
He can't play football at 80%, can he? He's 100% all the time. Or he was.
Yeah, I mean, he was getting that Wayne Rooney legs, wasn't he? Because he'd basically been playing full time since he was a teenager. And yeah, as you say, with no break at all and at quite a high level of intensity. But, I mean, that, at least Mkhitaryan had shown a sort of period of decline, whereas Sanchez just was really good up to just before we sold him. And then he's just, for just that last month with us, and then, you know, he's just fallen off a fucking cliff. I mean, it's extraordinary how a player that, you know, 2 years ago was scoring 30 goals and assisting 15 and looking like one of the best players in the country, and we turned down, what, 60 or 70 million from Man City, and now look at him. It's bonkers.
Speaking of Manchester City, I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
How old do you have to be not to be the young player of the year?
I think it might be 24.
It's mad. Or 20. Don't get me wrong, I'm a big Raheem Sterling fan. I'm really pleased for him. But 24 years old and he wins the Young Player of the Year award.
I think
he's been a professional 7 years.
I think that might be a sort of a part of a broader apology.
Yeah.
Sorry that we've all been a shit to you for a long time and you turned into a bit of a hero, so we want to give you some love. But we don't want to give you Player of the Year because there may be a couple other people who might be better for it.
Yeah. I was just 7 years as a professional, can you still be called, well, 7 years since having made your debut? It's not even 7 years as a professional. It was a professional before that.
Yeah, I mean, it really should be, I always felt it should be a rookie of the year.
Yeah.
Like first, like maybe it doesn't count to be a rookie if you're like, you've played 10 games, but if like your first year of being an established player, that's
like Paul Merson in 1989, for example.
For example.
Yeah.
The magic man.
Did you see, I know we're getting off Arsenal a little bit, but did you see the Harry's Heroes program?
See what, sorry?
The Harry's Heroes program.
No, I sort of worried it might be quite tragic.
So Harry Redknapp and John Barnes cobbled together a team of England legends.
And they played against Germany legends or something, didn't they?
So I'm slightly loosely, but yeah, they played against the team of German legends. It was two 90-minute programmes. It was very entertaining, actually, quite moving.
In what way?
Merce had a meltdown about the gambling and he went fishing with Robbie Fowler and Dave Seaman, and Robbie Fowler was like, oh shit mate, I never knew you were still struggling with that. And it was just he had Neil Ruddock, who's really struggling with his weight and on the verge of a heart attack. But it was like a programme that was almost, it was entertaining and you had football and there was a bit of comedy, but it was almost designed as like an issues programme as well, it felt. But not in a smashing you over the head with you sort of way. It was just, it was really, Ray Parler was there. I think Ray Parler should have his own TV show. So we were quite well represented. It's worth, if you can find it on ITV's...
ITV Player.
Yeah. It's worth checking out.
There you go. There's a recommendation for you, listeners, which we could do with at the moment. However, let's try and sort of move, think on a more positive things, because obviously we're moving away from domestic fixtures.
Yeah.
And just before I do that, actually, I have to say, a shame it couldn't be us due to some slightly dodgy refereeing and poor penalty taking. But wasn't it really funny that West Ham became the first team to win at White Hart Lane? Like, they're probably the only team that hates Spurs even more than us.
Yeah, well, it's funny that they were also the first team to win at the Emirates.
Indeed.
But it took months for someone to beat us there, not four games.
But they don't hate us as much as they hate Spurs, so it's not quite...
No.
Anyway, moving away from that, Europa League.
Yeah, Valencia. Valencia.
Who are in a decent run of form at the moment. Ah, great.
Yeah, I was, I'll be honest, I was sort of taking this match for granted a little bit, and then I looked at La Liga table and I was like, it might not be as straightforward as I thought it was going to be. And of course, we have a history with Valencia.
Yeah, although John Carew retired quite some time ago.
Yeah.
I mean, Valencia are sixth, so they're still below. I mean, yeah, they're playing well at the moment, but they're still 3 points behind Getafe. So that gives us some hope. And actually, I say Valencia are playing well at the moment. They've just hit a slightly dodgy patch of form. I mean, they beat Villarreal very easily in the Europa League, but Villarreal are near the bottom of the table in Spain, and, you know, Santi's trying to save them for relegation. But they've lost. They lost last weekend at home to Eibar. Presumably, they were resting players to the Europa League, but nonetheless. And they've lost the week before at Atletico Madrid, which, of course, is something we know about.
Indeed.
But having previous weeks beaten Real Betis, they're a little bit up and down, but they do have some dangerous players going forward. I mean, I don't know how much you know about Valencia and their team, but players we should definitely be looking out for are, I mean, Rodrigo, the forward, I believe he was the one that may have briefly been on loan at Bolton some years back. I may have got that wrong, but he... yeah, he spent 17 games on loan at Bolton Wanderers 9 years ago.
Oh, wow.
As a kid out of the Real Madrid youth team, and he'd just been sold to Benfica, and then was spent a year at Bolton, where he scored one goal against Wigan Athletic. There you go. But he has suddenly become quite dangerous for Valencia in the last couple of years, and has started getting into the Spain team. Although actually last season he scored 16 goals for them in the league, and this season he's got 5. So he's not. So thankfully his form has dropped off a bit. But they do have other players who are very much capable of posing a threat. Kevin Gamero, who had been at Atletico Madrid before that, and Sevilla, is always a dangerous striker, quick French striker. Santi Mina seems to get lots of goals in Spain without ever looking like that good a player. He's one of those funny players that seems to be quite a... Every time I watch Valencia highlights, he scores.
Right.
Having said that, that appears I've just seen all his goals, because he's only scored 10 goals all season, and I think I've seen every one of them. So maybe I'm overplaying that. But a player who is definitely dangerous is Gonçalo Guedes, the young Portuguese winger midfielder who went from Benfica to PSG for lots of money, and then PSG then bought Neymar and Mbappe, and were like, oh, well, we've just signed you, but we don't need you anymore.
Bye-bye.
So he was immediately sent on loan to Valencia, where he had a really good season last year, and then has just started hitting form recently, scored a couple of absolutely blinding goals in their win against Betis recently. And there are also some players that Arsenal fans might remember. Obviously, they got Francis Coquelin and Gabriel Paulista, the latter being as Arsenal-esque in his defending as he was at Arsenal. Capable of very good games, but also capable of spectacular cock-ups. Gave away a wonderful handball for a penalty not long ago. But one that Arsenal fans will remember for less happy reasons is Jeffrey Kondogbia. Do you remember him?
I do.
The player that after
the 35-yard thunderbolt.
Yeah, exactly. A player that after he played against us, we were like, we want him. He's like the left Patrick Vieira.
Sign him.
And then he went into Milan. It didn't really work out for him there, but he's gone to Valencia, and he's rediscovered his form there. So, you know, they're obvious players to look out for. And then there are a couple others like Jose Gaya, a left, very attacking left back, who, between him and Grimaldo, the Benfica left back, we've been linked with both for a couple of years. And I mean, they're not amazing defensively, but they're very good going forward. So he's definitely a threat. And they've got some solid defenders. They've got Ezequiel Garay, the ex-Real Madrid player. And do you remember Danny Parejo, midfielder?
No.
If I remember rightly, yeah, that's right. He played a season on loan at QPR when they got relegated.
Really?
Yeah. Because he'd come out through the Real Madrid youth ranks, and he was a great sort of free kick taker, and then went to QPR like when they were in the middle of their it's all going horribly wrong season.
Right, yes. Yeah, okay.
and then went back to Spain, rebuilt his reputation, and then has played 250 games for Valencia and has been like the mainstay of their midfield. And he's always a a pretty exciting player. Not in terms of dynamic, but he's a very technically sound player, and as I say, dangerous in free kicks. So yeah, there's some players to look out for there, but equally, they're not great defensively, Valencia, despite the fact they've got some decent players. I mean, they're...
For all our recent defensive horror shows where we've conceded three goals in for three games in a row for the first time since the bloody 60s, we still have a plus 20 goal difference in the most difficult league in the world. Whereas Valencia have a plus 8 goal difference and have accumulated rather less points than us in rather more in a similar amount of games.
So we're confident-ish. Well,
confident-ish, yeah. I mean, it's essentially, you know, we've got 66 points from 36 games with a plus 20 goal difference, despite the fact our recent domestic form has been an appalling clusterfuck. And Valencia have 52 points from 35 games. So clearly, I mean, we all know that Spain is a league where it's the Madrid clubs and Barcelona and then everyone else fights for scraps. But there is no doubt that our domestic form this season has been better than Valencia's. So we do go into the tie as favourites, but we have to not be complacent. And of course, we have to hope that our one-pace midfield can cope with the marauding runs of Condogbia alongside their otherwise one-pace midfield. So I think Aaron Ramsey is going to be a big miss in this one for us, the ability to find those pockets of space. But it is the kind of opponent that you quite fancy Mesut Ozil to have a significant impact against, I think.
Yeah.
And of course, we have the home game first, which is something we haven't had in a while in a European tie. Which, I mean, how do you stand on that? Because I know that some people always think that, oh, you know, it's always an advantage to play the second leg at home. But
well, Matthew, I'm glad you asked. I think the last time I was on the pod with Stephen, and the draw had just been made, and we'd been drawn at home first, and Stephen was like, oh, it's a disadvantage. And I'm not sure that it actually is.
I suppose it all depends on how that first game goes, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, if you lose 3-1 at home, then it was a disadvantage. If you win 3-0, then it's, you know, an advantage. A classic case. You can make a case either way, can't you? I mean, we lost 3-1 in... Was it 3-1 in Rennes? It was 3-1, wasn't
it? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then we took them apart at home, but by the same token, we beat Napoli 2-0 at home, and everyone was like, oh, is it enough? Is it enough? And it was more than enough.
Well, that's the thing. If you can get a good result and not concede an away goal at home, if you can win by a goal or two and keep a clean sheet, then that puts you in the driving seat.
I think that's exactly it. I mean, last year was the Atletico Madrid game when we drew 1-0 and yeah, we, by all accounts, should have murdered them.
Yeah, I've never seen
every Arsenal fan that watched that game knew that we weren't going to score in Madrid, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it was also just because they had 10 men for so long, and it was a game where, I mean, we all know how good Atletico are defensively, but it was the game where we suddenly went, we really shouldn't have let Giroud go to Chelsea because this is like the perfect fucking scenario for him. It was like the game we needed him more than any other game that season.
Yeah.
Because we were just like putting crosses into the box for like an hour. and then we had our one defensive fuck up and that was that.
Yeah. So basically, I think for us probably at the moment, it's probably quite good that we're at home first, because if we were going away to Valencia, bearing in mind the week we've just had.
Yeah, exactly.
It has the potential to get ugly quite quickly. Whereas at home, you'd expect us to, we'll be up for it. And generally in the big games at home this season, we've played well. So, yeah.
I mean, that's actually, I'm exactly with you on that. I think the fact that this is coming for us at this time at home, it's a change of pace from the Premier League, which has obviously fallen off a fucking cliff. It's a really good, you know, obviously it'd be nice if it was a really easy fixture, but there aren't really easy fixtures at this level of this competition. But it's a good time for us to be having this game to break things up for us and to, you know,
return to home comforts, and if we get a good result, it could really salvage the rest of the season. I mean, you know, obviously, if we completely bolt it up, then everyone will just be waiting until August. But if we can win 2-0 at home, like we did against Napoli, or put on at least that level of performance, that A, puts us in the driving seat to get to the final, but also could be a massive boost for those last couple of league games yet. And yes, we are no longer in control of our own destiny, but, you know, Spurs and Chelsea, despite theoretically having easier fixtures, have hardly been convincing in recent games. Their form has been almost as bad as ours. Man United have got 1 point more than us in the last five games, and Chelsea have got 5 points more than us in the last five games, but both are as inconsistent as us. And even Spurs, their form's been very unpredictable of late as well. There is hope, because Spurs have got to go away at Bournemouth, who are always tricky to play against, and then last day of the season they've got to play against Everton, who have just picked up their form. But in between that, they've got the two Champions League games against Ajax, which is going to be a challenge for them. United have got two very winnable games, Huddersfield and Cardiff, but United are behind us in the table anyway, so we could yet keep them at bay. And Chelsea have got Watford at home, dangerous, Leicester away, dangerous, either side of their Europa League fixtures. So, I'm not saying that us winning against Brighton at home or Burnley away are givens, but if we can get a good result, it could turn things around and then also help us to get back into the race for the top four. I've got a question for you that you may or may not know the answer to, because I don't know the answer to it.
Okay.
What happens if we finish fifth with the table as it is, with Man United sixth, Spurs third, Chelsea fourth, and then we get to the Europa League final against Chelsea and lose? And obviously that's a horrible scenario, but we'll be running...
It's really funny that you've asked that, because I was joking about that with a Chelsea fan before we started playing football last week.
But what happens then? Because we will be like... Because Chelsea will have qualified for the Champions League twice, and we'll be runner-up in both those scenarios. So, that's something I've been trying to find out, and I haven't been able to find out. So if anyone listening knows, please tell us.
Yeah, please tweet us. I think we just end up in the Europa League. That is my sense. because we haven't qualified for the Champions League.
So who gets that extra Champions League place then?
That's a good question, actually. I don't know. I assume it goes to...
If the Europa League is Champions League's world qualification, but the person who wins that is already in the Champions League... Answers on a postcard, too.
But we're going to win it.
Well, hopefully, yes. The good thing is this Chelsea team are at a very similar level to us, and in a one-off game, we've got it all depends on, can we stop Eden Hazard? And if so, we can beat Chelsea.
It'd be nice, because it was almost in 2006 when we were chasing Spurs down for that fourth spot. And then we knew we had the Champions League final if all else failed. But to have that pressure on that game would have been even worse than
ultimately
playing a Champions League final. You could see us still sneaking fourth somehow. I feel ridiculous saying it, bearing in mind how the last week's gone. But it's definitely not beyond the realms. And it'd be very nice if we were to get to the Europa League final not to have that pressure on us.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, obviously, if you gave me a choice between one or the other, I'd choose winning the Europa League, partly because it's a trophy, partly because it's a trophy we haven't won since 1970.
I think that's where Unai Emery is. I think I mentioned probably one of the first pods we did this season after he came in. I read an interview with him from about 3 years ago where he talked about it being like, you know, fans don't get excited about teams finishing fourth and getting into the group stages of the Champions League only to get knocked out. You make 20 million quid, but that isn't what excites fans. Fans are excited by winning trophies. So I'm with you. I know there's, for financial reasons, it's better for us to finish fourth. But
well, if we win the Europa League, we actually do. It's actually better for us because you get into the Champions League without having to go through that fucking qualifying round. So, you know, I've got no problem with Unai Emery putting his eggs in that basket. But obviously we have to try and beat Brighton at home at the weekend. And try and do it both ways just to be on the safe side. But
well, there's a couple of weeks gap as well between the end of the league season and the final, isn't there?
Yeah. So, which is why they're saying that if we get to the final, Aaron Ramsey will be back for it. which would be an Aaron Ramsey in a cup final. We know that goes pretty well generally. So
yeah,
that would be something to salvage the season. And also, I mean, hey, at least we're in a situation where we may be ballsing up the league, but at least we've got a couple of big European ties to look forward to. Yes, they might go horribly wrong, but at least we've still got that, because otherwise we'd be thinking pretty much everything would be on winning our next two home games and hoping someone else fucks up.
Yeah.
Whereas at least we've still got something, which means even though we've had an appalling week, a week and a half, performances and results-wise, it ultimately might not matter. which is a nice thought. A nice thought to finish with, I think, for this week. The only other thing I will say just before we wrap up is congratulations to both the Arsenal under-18s team that won their league. Well done, gentlemen. And, of course, to the Arsenal women's team, who not just won their league, they spanked their league.
Yeah, I was reading about that earlier, actually. The Guardian did a couple of articles about... there was one about how Manchester City had not won the league despite going unbeaten, but also the story of Arsenal's very successful league campaign despite a lot of injuries.
Yeah. Yeah, despite a lot of injuries. I mean, Sylvain talked about it last week in sort of anticipation of winning. And, of course, very happily in their kind of game to win the title, they absolutely breezed it, won 4-0. Vivienne Miedema managed to get runner-up for Women's Player of the Year to Nikita Paris, despite the fact she smashed all goal-scoring records and had better goals and assist figures than the Man City player. But the Man City player's English, so that's... And to be fair, has had a very good season. But yeah, so, I mean, after a few... it's been 7 years, I think, since they won the title, the Arsenal women, which for a team that was so dominant for so long was quite difficult to obviously endure. But yeah, they've absolutely stormed the title this year despite having a lot of serious injuries all season. They've had games where they've been having to fish players out of the youth team just to have enough players to have on the bench.
Yeah, I read that.
On quite a number of occasions. And a number of the players they've lost have been the result of, shall we say, disgusting tackles from rival teams as well.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, particularly where Kim Little had her leg broken by a Chelsea player who, I mean, thankfully it wasn't a massively serious leg break and she was able to come back in it in the same year. But that was just the result of a disgraceful tackle that went unpunished. And sadly, as women's football, the standard is increasing exponentially and is so much better than it was 10 years ago. Unsurprisingly, the standard of officiating isn't increasing at the same rate because... well, because there's less people in it to improve in the same way and for a whole range of reasons involving professionalism, what have you. So, and a lot of the people who referee women's games are also people who referee a lower league football or non-league football and therefore are slightly more tolerant of it, the old ultra-violence. but that's, you know, something that I think the powers that be are aware of and hopefully we'll see resolved. But yes, also, just to reiterate that the Arsenal under-18s team won the under-18s South League with 60 points from 22 games, which is basically played 22, won 20, with a plus 63 goal difference, which not only put them 4 points ahead of a also very good under 18 from 18 team from Spurs, but also we've got them 9 points more than the under 18 North League champions Derby County, with Arsenal having a goal difference that was 27 goals superior and having 9 more points accumulated over the course of the season. So a very, very impressive performance from the under 18s. The under 23s had a bit of an up and down season, so with so many players away on the bench with the first team for so much of the season, but actually rallied to finish second in the under 23 league just behind Everton, with a great run of form towards the end of the season despite star players like Nelson and Smith Rowe being on loan. So at least with all having no money and loads of players we want to replace, at least the youth groups are doing really well at the moment, which is, you know, not to be sniffed at.
Absolutely not. Well
right. done. I think that's a good time to knock it on the head. We found some positivity eventually.
Because now in 20 minutes.
But yeah, other than that, there's nothing much to say except for let's hope for a good result this Thursday. It would be such a boost for the club. I think... What's your... Okay, scoreline prediction for Thursday just before we wrap up.
2-0.
Oh, nice. Classic. Classic. I'm going to go for 3-1.
Yeah, that was the other one I had in my head. I thought I'd go for the slightly more positive. They're not going to score.
Other than that, let's hope we get a good result there and against Brighton. If anyone wants to get in touch at Daily Cannon Pod on Twitter. That's at Daily Cannon Pod. And we'd love to hear from you, even if it's just to explain to us why we're all wrong or don't understand the rules about European qualification, or if you want to tell me to talk less or anything like that. It's all gravy.
Surely not, mate. Surely not.
Well, I don't know. Anyway, have a good week, Paul. May the snooker fulfil you in whatever way it does. I don't understand that.
I'm not sure how to respond to that, so I won't.
Good, okay. But generally, have a good week.
And, no, thank you.
And
you
have a good week to you listeners, and we'll be back in your ears this time next week. Take care. Bye-bye.
Cheers.